California State Library about alcoholism and was recorded at the annual summer conference of the Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous, held in Richmond, California on June 8th, 9th, and 10th, 1973. This is the 8:30 p.m. Saturday night open public AA meeting. The speaker, Clarence Snyder of Castleberry, Florida. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for entertainment or commercial purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of any speaker at any public level. The original of this recording and this copy were both made by Bart Daniel of 1332 Santa Inez Way, Sacramento, California.
Clarence S. came all the way from Castleberry, Florida. So I'm now going to turn the meeting over to Clarence S. Florida.
Thank you. Well, I want to first of all thank the committee for asking me to come here. We're here to talk about rummies, I guess. Miracles tonight also, because I think first of all it's a miracle that I am here, and secondly I think it's a miracle that any of us are here. But I'll tell you one thing, I am rather a freak in this AA association, in as much as I came to a fellowship that didn't yet exist. When I came to this fellowship, it was not yet known as Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into the old Oxford movement, same movement that Bill Wilson and Doc Smith were introduced to. And eventually, AA evolved from this. It is a miracle the way I got here. Let me tell you a few things about it. I had, at the time, I had been married to a gal who was a member of a very clannish family. And this family seemed to congregate around my home most of the time. I'd have one, two, three, or four of them in there. And these people, as I say, were very clannish, and they used to have a lot of family conferences. And these conferences were among them. I was never invited to them because I was usually the subject under consideration. They would alternately throw me out of my house and then relent and let me back in. So finally, the last conference of all conferences was taking place. And the upshot of the whole thing was that I would be able to stay in my own home, providing that I would go to work for my wife's brother. He had a large truck, he had a tractor trailer out of it. He hauled merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back. And I was supposed to break in and become his helper. Well, I was never on a truck in my life, and the idea of driving one of those big outfits was quite frightening to me. And it also suggested hard work, and that was likewise frightening. I had not worked for a good long time, and I was what you might call unemployable. And if you don't believe I was unemployable, I will give you a couple of examples. In the first place, during those years, it was the years of depression, and Roosevelt was president during one of his terms. And during this time, Roosevelt backed this WPA plan, where men were to go to work and do whatever they could or make believe they're working. And for this, they would get $18 a week. All of my jug buddies got on this WPA kick, and they wouldn't take me. Now, any of you folks who are old enough to know anything about WPA, you'll think of a fellow who is not would not even qualify for it. I would say he is a pretty sorry lot. I have maintained a resentment toward Roosevelt ever since then. Well, if that isn't bad enough, my wife had always been acutely interested in my going to work, and she did everything she could do. And you know what her job was? She worked. She had it. The family had to eat. And her job, she was the head of the men's department in an employment bureau, and she couldn't get me a job. So I would say I wasn't very much as far as employment was concerned. Well, things rocked on, and his brother-in-law took me with him on a trip to New York, where I was to learn to be a truck driver. He fixed up this little sleeper cab of his so that I was to sleep up in the back, and he would sleep on the seat when any sleeping was to be done. He fixed it up real nice and put a curtain and a window and everything for me. It was real sweet. And we started off for New York, and it was cold weather when we started off. It was the beginning of winter. Everything happens to me in the lousiest of weather, and this was no exception. We started for New York, and he drove all night long, and I thought, well, this man never stops. He didn't notice that I had a few dimes secreted around in my various pockets so they wouldn't rattle. He didn't know I had any capital. And he drove all day the next day, and the following evening we hit Albany, New York, and he really wore out, so he had to take a rest. So we pulled the outfit over to the side of the street, and he said, I'm going to take a nap here for an hour. I says, fine, this is the capital of New York State. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. So this was the first chance I had to get away from him. I got out of that truck and I ran down the street and got into the first place I signed, but I found that was not a place that was suitable to a man of my estate, so I moved on to another one and found one that was more suitable. I got in this joint and I found an angel, and I was throwing those things in me as fast as they came, and I went out the back door. Started down the street toward the truck, and I hadn't had a drink for 2 days. Which was some kind of a record. And these hit me all at once. So when I start climbing up into this truck, I stepped on his poor boy's face. And of course, he knew what was up and church was out. So he carried me on into New York City, and he took this outfit of his down on the waterfront, and he threw me out, and there he left me, and he told me that's the end of the line, and that's the end of me. Well, I'm in New York. I'm 600 miles away from home. I don't have a dime. I don't have anything. I don't have an overcoat. I have no wardrobe. I sold all that long hence. And I had to figure out a way to exist. So I thought of another sister of his that lives out in Yonkers. And this, I thought, certainly Virginia owed me something. She used to come to my home, and she stayed there a long time. At one time when she had an operation, I took care of all these things. This was from years previously. And I figured that she'd look after me, do something for me. And I knew where she lived in Yonkers because I was there on my honeymoon. A very clannish family. They did everything together. So I made it out to Yonkers, and I remember she used to live way up on top of a hill. But you know, I didn't go up on a hill right away. I went down a hill, and I got down there in the Italian section, and I met some very interesting new friends, and we all got into this Dago Red. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I guess I was a sight for sore eyes. I can only remember a few things about that trip to her home. I remember rolling around on the floor with her two little daughters. They're little kids. They're just youngsters, 3, 4 years old. And I was dirty, I was drunk, and I stunk. And Virginia took a dim view of this performance, so she put me in the back of her car, and she drove me back down to the waterfront from whence I came and threw me out where her brother had done. And there I was. I shall never forget that day, because I think this is the day that I realized this is the loneliest day of my life. I remember standing on that waterfront, and what occurred to me was that there wasn't one person in this whole world who cared one bit whether I was alive or dead. I had no more friends, I had no more family, I had known nothing. This was the end of the line. So I had to exist, and I found a way to do it in New York. If ever you're in a bad way, there's a town with more suckers per square mile than any place in the world. And if you have any wits at all, which Alki usually has, you can get along. And I did get along for a long time there. I tell this story for a reason. Sometime later, Virginia had the doctor to her home for one of the kids. Of course, I knew nothing about this. And they got to talking about drinking, which always seemed to be a favorite subject among society. And Virginia related the story to her doctor about my visit to her and what a nice guy I used to be, her favorite brother-in-law, and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum I am now. I had a brother-in-law who was a drunk, and he got mixed up with some strange cult of people. And since he got mixed up with these people, he hasn't drank anymore. He don't drink anymore, and he runs around trying to fix other drunks. And he says, likewise, there's a doctor, a medical doctor down in Akron, Ohio, who was also a drunk and has quit, and he spends all of his time fixing drunks. We used to call it fixing in those days. So he says, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down to Akron and meet this doctor, and this doctor can fix him. So, of course, I don't know this is going on. But apparently Virginia relayed this information to Dorothy back in Cleveland, and eventually I made my way back to Cleveland a year or so later, and it was still winter time, another winter it was though, and I charged up on the front porch of where I lived, hoped to get in the nest, and Dorothy met me at the door, and there's snow about 4 feet deep out there. And I noticed when I went up on the porch, the screen doors were still up, and the screens were up. And she's talking to me through this screen door. And I pointed this thing out to her. I pointed out the fact that she needed a man around the house to take care of the details. And she allowed as though she did need a man around the house, but she sure didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in. But she did tell me about this doctor, Smith. Dr. Bob Smith in Akron, Ohio, who fixes drunks, and asked me if I'd like to go down and meet him. So what could I lose? I wasn't going to get in the net. I might as well try whatever I could get. So I said, yes, I'd like to meet this doctor. So Dorothy put me in her car. They're always riding me someplace, this family. And she took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. And she put Doc Smith's name and address in my grimy little paw and told me goodbye. So that's how I met my sponsor. I went down to meet Doc, and I shall never forget that meeting with him. It was cold weather, it was zero, and he wasn't in his office when I got there, and I had to wait for him for what seemed to be an awful long period of time. And I'd walk up and down that corridor in front of his office, I was afraid to leave the place because I was afraid I'd get out on a stem, I might get picked up. And it was good and warm in there anyway, so I might as well stay till he came. But every time I passed his door, I'd read on his on the door his name, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon. Now I'm going down to get fixed. Seemed like a new approach to the problem. Finally, Doc came. And many of you folks who knew Doc, and there are people here who had that pleasure and that privilege, they know him to be a tall, angular fellow. He way tall, thin, and he had fingers on him this long. He was a man made for his profession. But you know, this fella scared me to death. He ushered me in through his two offices into the back and sat me down there, and I got prepared to tell him all about my symptoms. But the thing about it is, he took the ball away from me and started telling me all about me. And something happened up here in this blubber of mine. I couldn't figure out how this guy knew so much about me. And then something occurred to me that frightened me, really scared me to death. Now, Dewey and anyone from Cleveland here will well remember this incident. Years ago, they had a thing going on in Cleveland that the newspaper men had a great time about. They had more fun with that than they had with this Watergate deal. And there was somebody that was working down at Kingsbury Run, which was a hobo hangout. And what they were doing is somebody down there would sneak one of these hobos away when he's asleep, and he'd cut him all up in little pieces. And they used to find these pieces of bodies all over the place wrapped in newspaper. They found, I think, 7 bodies altogether, and they never identified but only one of them to some fingerprints. And the newspaper boys were conjecturing that either this was a butcher that's doing this, or it was some surgeon who'd gone a little bit wacky and he was getting his jollies out of cutting people up. And they nicknamed this killer, who they're trying to locate, is the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. Now, Johnny and Dewey will remember this incident, I'm sure. I don't see how they could forget it. So Doc is talking to me and telling me all about myself. And how does this guy know all this stuff, see? Then the next thing he does, here's what kills me with him. He wanted to put me out in some goonie roost out in Cuyahoga Falls where no one could get out me. About this time, I've got through here that he's the Mad Butcher. He's been following me around, and he knows all this about me. I'm his next victim. And when he wants to put me someplace where nobody can get at me, I want to be somewhere where everybody can get at me. So I ran out of his office, my first opportunity, and I never stopped for elevators. I went down those 7 floors, bing, 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 and out of that building. And away I disappeared. But I couldn't forget this man. Now, I want to point this out for this reason. I want to demonstrate how serious I was about quitting drinking. I went back home and I resumed my social amenities with my jughead gang that I was getting boozed up with all the time. We were sitting around one day in our habitat, and we got to talking about quitting drinking. I think I started this, initiated this conversation. And I made this broad, bland statement that I was going to quit drinking. Now, here's something that
guy sitting there, a flannel-mouthed Irishman, and he's drunk, too. And when I announced that I was going to quit drinking, he turns on me and says, "You quit drinking? You'll never quit drinking. You haven't got guts enough to quit drinking." He says, "You're no damn good. You'll never quit." And he's drunk, too, of course. I says, "I am going to quit drinking. I'll show you." He says, "You show me. You can't show anybody anything." I says, "I know a doctor down in Akron that can fix me." He says, "No doctor can fix you. You're no damn good." He says, "You know, to quit drinking," he says, "takes determination. And to have determination, you need a chin." He says, "Look at you. You got a chin like Andy Gump. You're no damn good." I says, "Well, I'll show you." He says, "You go ahead and show me." So I got a hold of someone's telephone. I'm sure we didn't have telephone service in our little layout there. So whose phone I got, I don't know, but I got someone's, because these were long-distance calls. And Doc told me I called him numerous times. I don't remember that. I remember talking to him once. And he told me to meet him at Akron City Hospital the next morning. And at Akron City Hospital, I was the next morning. I shall never forget that day. There was another zero blizzard going on out there in Akron when I got off that bus. And I didn't have the fare to get out to this hospital, and I had to walk out to this Akron City Hospital. And I know there's people here who've been in Akron, and they call that the city of seven hills. Well, it's all hills, and every hill is up. There's no downhills, seemingly. I had to walk up these hills to get out of this hospital. Now, you picture this. Zero. I don't have an overcoat, nothing. And I walked out there. When I got out to that hospital, I was sweating. And when I walked into the lobby of this hospital, I fainted dead away, passed out. I didn't know anything until I came to, and I'm up in a room, there's a lot of commotion around, and they're giving me a bath for some reason or other. And a lot of people around me, I seem to be the center of attraction. And people, all kinds of people there. And I opened my eyes, I looked around, one of the very first things I saw when I opened my eyes was over on that windowsill was a bottle of rub. And I thought, "Oh boy, I'm down here to quit drinking, but if worse gets to worse and I start hearing music, there's my answer on that windowsill." And I figured there'd be a bottle of rub and probably in every room on that floor. So if anything would have happened, I had just the fear of DTs. I never had them, but some of my drug buddies had them, and I have some experiences with them before. And I didn't want them. And I knew what the earmarks were. So I'd have had some of that rub, all right. So in comes this nurse with a tray. I can remember this. Got two glasses on this tray. One with some white stuff, and the other was a nice, great, big hooker of whiskey. And she says, "Mr. Snyder, we have some medicine for you. You take this medicine and drink this whiskey after it, and it'll do you a lot of good." And I know what that medicine was. That was formaldehyde. It tastes like the bottom of a birdcage, but it really can put you to sleep. So I cussed her out. I said, "I came down here to quit drinking, not to drink any of your booze or anything else. So I wouldn't take the drink. Real smart guy I was, you know." So I have never had a drink since the day before I went to that hospital, which was the 11th day of February, 1938. In that hospital a week, and you can't tell me anything about shaking out a drunk. I've been drunk for some years. I was not a periodic drinker. I was a chronic. I was drunk all the time. And when one quits after all those years, believe me, I went through hell. forget it. And I can feel for any person that's doing that. Well, anyway, that doesn't make me a hero. More of a damn fool. I should have taken that drink. I've been more humane to myself. But anyway, I'm glad I never have had one. I weighed 130 pounds when I was in that hospital. Wasn't much to me. I hadn't eaten in a long time. I didn't eat all the time I was in that hospital for a week. I remember this very well, because the last day I was in that hospital, Paul Stanley came in the morning, and he got my breakfast. He ate my breakfast for me. He was there at lunch, and he got my lunch. I got the dessert. I got the peach that they gave me for dessert. He ate the rest of it. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, Doc came in as usual. People call him Dr. Bobby. He's always Doc Smith to us. Doc came in and he sat on the foot of my bed, as was his usual custom, a very unprofessional posture, but he always did it. And he always sat there for a minute and looked at me. I always had a feeling that man could look right through me, and I believe he could. So he finally says, well, he says, young fellow, what do you think of all this? All these men had come in and visited me while I was in the hospital, and they told me the stories of their careers, of their drinking careers. They were all older men than I was. They were all fellas 40 to 50 years old and up. And I had just hit 35 at the time. I says, well, Doc, I says, I think this is great. These men come in and talk to me. They tell me the story of their life, and they tell me all about what happened to them with booze. And I know they're all 24-karat rummy, but I says, I'm puzzled about one thing. He says, and what's that? I said, well, these fellows all tell me they have the answer to my problem, but they don't tell me what the answer is. I've been here a week. What happens now? What are you going to do to me now? What do I have to do? What's the answer to this whole thing? He says, well, young fellow, he says, we don't know about you. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any luck with young fellas. They're all screwballs. He says, we're not too sure that you're ready for this yet. My God, ready for this yet? What do you have to be ready? I had no home, I had no money, I had no clothes, I didn't know where I'd go when I was at hospital. I had no friends, I had nothing, period. So I had to convince him I was ready. This is a different approach than what people get today, you know? A lot of things have changed. People have an idea that change is great. And so many people try to change this program. Damn, we don't need this program change. These people got to change themselves. That's what we need. Well, anyway, Doc thought that I probably wasn't ready. I had to convince them. I said, so I guess I finally did. And he says, well, he says, young fella, I'll give you the answer to this. So he turns around, he points this big, long, bony finger at me, and he says, young fella, he says, do you believe in God? Well, believe me, that's the last thing I wanted to hear from a doctor. I had gone the mission route during my career, and I wanted no part of this, and when I heard this, I thought, oh, my God in heaven, here I am in a hospital, and I'm obligated to a bunch of religious nuts. See? And I had to evade this question. But you don't evade, Doc. He's waiting for this answer. So, do I believe in God? And I says, well, I says, what does that have to do with it? I thought that was a real smart rejoinder. He says, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or don't you believe in God? Boy, he means business. So the next smart one I come up with is, well, I guess I do. The big bony finger again. There's no guessing about it. You do or you don't. This is the way they give the spiritual foundation of AA to us. So I finally had to break down and admit that I did. He says, well, that's fine. Now we can get someplace. He says, get out of that bed. I says, for what? Get down on your knees. I says, for what? He says, we're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He said, you're going to pray. I said, I don't know anything about praying. He said, I don't suppose you do, but you get down there just the same. I'll pray, and you can repeat after me, and that'll be due for this time. So he bounces me out of that nice warm nest on that cold concrete floor in my shorty nighties. And he utters a prayer, and I repeated it. I don't know what it was. But I do remember this, that after he concluded, he shook hands with me and he said, young fella, you're going to be all right. And that night he carried me to a meeting. This was not a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't born yet. This was a meeting of the Oxford Movement at T. Henry's home in Akron, Ohio. That's where Doc had been going to meetings, and that's where he took his boys and he sobered them up. The alcoholics in the Oxford Movement were a minority. They were not the majority. The Oxford Movement were a bunch of people trying to live better lives by the application of Christian principles and living by guidance.
Like me.
And they looked at me and they don't want to be like me. I learned very early in life that a prophet is without honor in his own home. So I had to go on the highways and the byways, and I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in AA history. I went every place where there were rummies, and believe me, it was a virgin territory. Up to this time, there had never been anything outside of things like the Samaritan Cure and the Keeley Cure and some of those aversion cure drugs that were used to fix rummies, and they didn't usually have to kill them, but they didn't do much fixing. But here was a plan to help rummies, and I was told to go out and fix these rummies. Believe me, I don't know how I ever lasted, but it took me 7 long months before I got my first rummy in the hospital. And this was after diligent effort, lots of ambition, but no sense. I talked to thousands of rummies, really, collectively and individually. I'd lay down with them, I'd stand up with them, anything. I finally found one, and I could write a book about that first rum I ever got. It was a rare experience. I wish I had the time to tell you about it tonight. It's terrific. But I finally got this guy and got him in the hospital in Akron. And believe me, I was walking on air after this happened, but I figured now I am really a member. I have arrived. I can look back and see why it took me 7 long months to get that fellow. I was carrying a message, supposedly, but I had no message. This is one of our big problems today. A lot of people are running helter-skelter all over Hell's Half Acre after rummies, carrying some message they don't have. There's a time when we're supposed to do this, according to our program. It says something about that in the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. But people come in, and the first thing you know, they're out there sponsoring 9 people. With what? What kind of a message? I found that after this first fellow, the next ones came quite rapidly. And eventually we had about a dozen rummies going down to Akron each week from Cleveland. Now here's where AA started. Here's some history you do not read in the literature that's approved. Men, I had told them that this program of recovery would not interfere in any way with their religious beliefs, if they had any, nor with anything that had to do with their church, if they had one. And as it happened, 8 of these first dozen men happened to be Roman Catholics. And I told these fellows it wouldn't interfere. So our format of a meeting in the Oxford movement was like this. First of all, before the meeting started, they had a guidance meeting where some people went down in the T. Henry's recreation room and had a quiet time for a half an hour. And they were supposed to get guidance. They all took pads and pencils, and whatever came to them in meditation, they'd write it down. And this is how a leader of the meeting was chosen for the night, through guidance. Then when the meeting started, the leader was tapped, and he thought that was a great privilege to lead the meeting. And the format was this. He was to open the meeting with an audible prayer. Then he was to read scripture, any scripture he was guided to read or any of his favorite passages or verses or chapters. Read as much as he wanted or he felt inclined to. And this was out of the King James Version, if you please. And these Irish are looking at this guy. The next thing you know, after he gets through reading his scripture, the leader witnesses, and he tells all about his sins and how he has met with them and overcome them or what has happened about them. After he runs out of gas, the other people in the room, in the audience, they get up and do their witnessing. And it gets pretty sticky sometimes. Which is all right. It's good. I'm not criticizing people in that way, but I'm just mentioning. When you've told a bunch of people this is not going to interfere with their religion, you're getting yourself in pretty hot seat. Because they look at this performance, they look at each other, they look at me. And I get static all the way back to Cleveland that night. So something had to give. In the fall of 1938, we wrote the KA book. You notice what I said about that? We wrote that book. This book was not written by one person. It's a conglomerated effort of a lot of people. And they were not all Alfies either. Okay, but most of them were. Well, anyway, with this book, we evolved a program of 12 steps. We did not have these 12 steps in the Oxford movement. We had the same plan. The Oxford movement called their plan a life-changing program. It involved an admittance of a need for a change in your life. It involved admitting to a God. It involved a surrender of our life and will to God. And it involved living according to the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And it involved missionary work, going out and converting other people. When the 12 steps were written, they were simplified this program so that an alcoholic, no matter what his belief was, or if he had very little of any, he could accept this program, as long as he believed in a higher power. It would not interfere with anyone's religion, etc. So I'm having this problem with all these Catholic boys. But they didn't have this problem in Akron. They had no Catholics in the Oxford group in Akron. Only one man who had ever been a Catholic, was old Phil Smith. Phil was a fallen away Catholic, which meant he was screwed up anyway. And he never could catch on. By the time he got mixed up with people in Unity and in Christian Science and all the other denominations and his Oxford group, he was more screwed up than ever. The guy didn't have a chance. Eventually, the poor guy died. But he was the only fellow who was closely related to Catholicism in the Akron outfit. But we had a preponderance of them in Cleveland. So we had to do something. The best thing I could think of was to go and talk to my sponsor about it, which I did. Went down and talked to Doc and told him what our problem was. He says, well, we're not keeping them out. I says, no, you're not keeping them out. The church keeps them out. He says, well, that's tough. I says, no, that can't. It doesn't have to be tough. We don't need all these things that are in the Oxford group that are not acceptable to these people. Says, we have a program now of 12 steps and four absolutes, and that's all we need. We don't need all this other falderall, getting guidance for other people and all that sort of thing, and open confessions. He says, well, we can't do anything about that. I says, oh, yes, we can. He says, like what? I says, well, you'll wait and see what's like what. If you're not going to change here, we'll change. Had another rummy, another Irishman, if you please, in the hospital at the time. In fact, Bill Wilson helped me put him in. Bill came to visit me one time, and I was going out to call on old Al Goldrick. And I said, Bill, you want to talk to me? He's going to have to come along, because I got to see this guy tonight. I think he's right. So he went with me. I had wrestled with this bird for all winter long. But Bill had something to offer him and convinced the guy, and he decided to go down the next morning. In fact, Bill took him down to Akron for me, which was great. Well, Al was in the hospital when this was taking place, and I went out to see Al's wife, Grace, whom I met long before I ever met Al. And told her our problem, and could we use her home for a meeting hall? She had a big home. They were losing it, but they still had it. And she was delighted to use her house for a meeting. So next week, I went down to Akron and made the announcement. I said, this is the last week that the Alton from Cleveland will be down here in a body. We're going to start our own group in Cleveland next Thursday night at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. And it is not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. And only alcoholics and their immediately interested family are welcome. Nobody else. Well, you can imagine what happened. The roof went off the house. This was the first riot we ever had in AA. This was the first display of unity. AA was born in a riot, and it grows in riots. We had one hell of a night there. They said, Clarence, you can't do this. Well, it's done. Well, let's come down and talk this over. There's nothing to talk about. We've done it. Well, if I thought that was a rough night, you should have seen next Thursday night. They all came up in a body and crashed our meeting and tried to break it up. And one fellow was going to whip me. And these were good Christian people, however. But some other people got between us and probably saved my skin. But we held our ground, and that's the way we started. And we started building our group, and we started to go. It wasn't too long afterwards that we got those terrific articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, where we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inquiries from all over the country. This is what put AA on the map. This is stuff you don't read, but this is history. Finally, after 6 months, if I thought we had a riot in Akron, and if I thought we had a riot at our first meeting, you should see what happened in 6 months in Cleveland. We had more unity. And we unified into three groups instead of two. We had an awful riot, and they voted me out of AA. I ever voted out of AA. But a lot of other people didn't agree with it, so that's where the riots came in. So we split in three groups. Two on the east side and one on the west side. And from those groups, others have broken off, so they have several hundred of them up there now. Thousands and thousands of rummies. Now this is miraculous. I look back on these days, those early days of this fellowship, and I think back and I look at that guy back there who was me. It's impossible. It couldn't be. He couldn't have done this. He couldn't have done that. And it's true, I couldn't have done it. I take no credit for these things. I've learned, and I learned long ago, that whatever we do, we are only agents being used. Because the things that occurred to me in the early days of my AA career, in the first few years, I had absolutely no capacity to perform of myself. This is true. I say this very humbly. The things that I did and people I met, people I had to be with, it's unbelievable when I look back on it. Had to be directed, God directed, because I didn't have that much sense. I didn't have that much strength. I didn't have that much influence. I didn't have that much education. I didn't have anything like that that would ordinarily be ascribed to a person who's supposed to really get some moving. I had an awful lot of enthusiasm, and I had very strong convictions about things. I'm a Dutchman, and I got a hard head. And when I get something in my nut, it takes an awful lot to kick it out. And there's some things I got in my head very early in my career, put there by my sponsor and other people who took interest in me, that you couldn't beat out of my head with an axe. They're still there. I learned a lot of things from people in that old Oxford group. I learned more
things after meetings than I think than I ever learned during meetings, because a lot of this stuff confused me during meetings. I hear people talk in AA, they say they've never been to a bad meeting. Boy, I've been to some stinkeroos. Believe me, they've never heard a bad lead. Oh, boy, I don't know where they've been all this time. I heard some awful ones. I've heard thousands of meetings, too. In 35 years, you do. You hear a lot of them. But anyway, people talked to me a good deal. They took an interest in me, and I stuck with those fellows like glue. And I'll never forget one thing that happened to me. I like to always talk about this, because there's a thing that probably did more to change my life than any one thing during my career down in Akron. Every night after a meeting, this big fella, Bill Van Horn, he's a great, big, rough, tough character. Bill had preceded me in the group by 6 months. Bill had a pension from the First World War. And every month when he'd get this pension, he'd go berserk. He'd get drunk, and he used to like to fight policemen. And he never seemed to get the idea in his head that he couldn't win. There's just too damn many of them. But he would do it. And finally, his family got tired of this, and they thought for his own good they put him away. So they probated him and had him put in the Massillon State Insane Asylum. And there he was, and that's where Doc found him, Doc Smith. And Doc took him out of that nut factory and put him in the group, and Bill never had another drink the rest of his life. Now, this is a big, rough, tough guy. Somehow or other, he took an awful shine to me, and he used to always get me in a corner after meetings and talk to me. And I'll tell you the truth, I was about half scared of this guy, too. He's a big guy, and he'd come out of a nut factory, and, you know, I expect anything. So one night he got me in a corner, and he said, Clarence, he says, I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball of wax. He says, I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize this, and I don't want you to ever forget it. So this is the answer. So I can still see Bill like it's last night. He's standing there at a library table in T. Henry's living room, and he takes out his billfold, and he starts taking all these papers and pictures and cards and all this debris out of it and piling it on this little table. So finally he finds what he's looking for, and it's a slip of paper, and he holds it up to me. And I take this slip, and I look at it, and here is a Bible verse. And I look at that, and I look at this big gorilla, and I think, oh boy, he is going. But I did what Bill told me to do. I did memorize it, and I have not forgotten it. And it was one of my very favorite verses in the good book. It is the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the 17th verse. And it reads this way. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. How about that? If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. All things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. What about your life here? Is it anything like it used to be? Is there a person sitting in this room who had the same life he had before he came here? Look at this gang sitting out here, all dressed up and shined up, beautiful, like this man said a while ago. You're beautiful people. You are. Just think what this crowd would do if you'd all fall of a sudden right now, it'd revert. Just think. You talk about earthquakes and fires. That would be child's play. They could move this arena here down to Los Angeles. Every person here has been touched with something. I'm so convinced of that. When I came to this fellowship, we didn't have the big book. We didn't have the literature. We didn't have any of these nice things we have today. So we were taught out of the good book. My sponsor used to teach me out of the Bible. I'd ask him a question, and he'd say, well, what does it say in the good book? I say, how do I know? You're the teacher, you tell me. He said, read it and find out. It's a sponsorship. He said, the Bible has an answer for every human problem, everything you need. I'd ask him a question. I remember one time, for instance, I said, what's the meaning of all this first things first business? What does that mean? Tell me. He says, what does it say in the book? I said, how do I know? He says, read and find out. I said, you tell me. He says, well, first things first means this. It says very plainly in that Bible, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. See? First things first. Does this ever occur to you? This is the kind of teaching they gave me. I'm not teaching a Sunday school class up here. I'm telling you what happened to me when I came here. I hear a lot of people talking about what happened to them in AA and before they got here. This is how they taught me. You know, it's a funny doggone thing. I've been sober for over 35 years. Maybe there's something to the way they taught me. You know? I learned early in my career that our whole entire AA program came from the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. I was also taught that every experience and everything we needed, we could learn from reading that book, that good book. He even told me about slippers. There's a piece in the Bible that explains why slippers have such an awful bad time coming back. When some person comes to AA and he has the benefit of this way of life for some time, and then he reverts and goes back, something happens to him. And there's a piece in the good book about that. And you find it both in Luke and in Matthew. But it has to do with the unclean spirit. It says, when the unclean spirit has gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest. And finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept clean and garnished. See? Then he goeth and taketh with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last estate of that man is worse than the first. How about that? People say, why does a person have such a time when he has the benefit of this, and then he turns his back on it? Seven other spirits come in worse, and the last estate of that man's worse than the first. I've seen this happen. Believe me, I know two fellows. Dewey and Johnny know these two fellows. They had over 30 years of sobriety and have gotten drunk. And there are reasons why they got drunk. There are reasons why anybody gets drunk after they have had this benefit. And I know the reasons for these fellows, and I pray for them. And I hope they can come back. But their chances of recovery are so remote. Because it takes so much to get those seven other ones out of their house again. See? It's pitiful. 30 years these boys had, both of them. And both of them are smart fellas, sharp. Made great successes of their life during the 30 years they were sober, both of them. One fellow moved out of the town, and he moved to a small town over in another state, away from all these people in AA whom he spent 30 good years with. And he got fancy, and he joined a lot of clubs, and he forgot all about trying to carry any message over there. He got interested in a lot of earth people. And you know, when they get interested this way and they change. He gets the idea that he gets thinking. Now, this is the worst thing an alcoholic can ever do, is get thinking. I hear people talk about coming in here and changing their thinking. God help them. Because what does an alcoholic have to think with when he gets here? If he has anything to think with, he wouldn't be here. An alcoholic don't think. One of the worst things that ever happened in AA with some dodo that I know him very well, he got a hold of a whole crate of these signs, think. He got them from the IBM company. They used to send around all their customers. And this guy thought that this would be a great idea, send around all the groups so he can have them in the clubhouses and other podiums and all this stuff. Think. Well, that's one heck of a thing to confront a rummy with when he walks into AA. If he just don't, a rummy don't think. You know the big difference between a rummy and an earth person? The outstanding difference is this. The earth people think, and rummies feel. If you put a sign there, feel, that'd be something. No think. It takes about 3 years of consistent effort and a lot of good counseling and a lot of trying and a lot of reading and a lot of studying and a lot of application for an alcoholic coming to AA to even begin to get a little bit logical. We're the most illogical people in the world. I get a kick out of some of these brethren. They come in here and talk about that second step and says something about restoring them to sanity.
I'm not nuts.
You aren't? Well, what are you doing here? You're not nuts. How about these periodic drunks? Well, you know, there's two kinds of rummies. There's a periodic and there's a chronic. I was a chronic. I drank all the time. People knew what to expect of me. I was consistent. But take these periodics. Those are the people that ought to be barred. They are something else. What do they do? They're the first ones that'll squawk about insanity, too. They'll get themselves a good job, a nice house, nice car, nice wife, nice family, nice furniture. Everything is going good, and they're advancing in business and going swell. And all of a sudden, poof, they blow the whole bundle. And they get drunk, and the job goes, the family goes, the car goes, the furniture goes, everything goes, and they wind up a bum. So what does this guy do? He gets another job, usually a better one than he had. See? Gets another nice wife, another nice house, another nice job, nice furniture, nice car, everything good, and he joins the Chamber of Commerce, and he joins the KSC and the Masons and everybody. And the next thing you know, blows that all out. And this guy tells me he shivers when you mention insanity to him. Believe me, when they told me I was nuts, I welcomed that. Because it got me off the hook for a lot of things. Yes, sir. This thing of working with alcoholics is a wonderful experience. And we learn things. But we learn to live with one another, and we learn what life is all about. We learn what's important. But alcoholics, this society of ours, you and I are the most blessed of all people. It's a miracle that any of us are here. I always like to mention this. Alcoholism has been with us as long as time has been recorded. We read about alcoholism in ancient history. We read about it in mythology.
We read about it in the Bible.
A lot of good rummy stories in the Bible. I think last time I was here, I told you a few of them. Some terrific rummy stories. Do you want to hear one or two? The first rummy story in the Bible, you'll find in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis. Read the story of Noah and the ark. Boy, did he ever get potted on that ark. And who but a rummy would ever do a thing that he did? And I'd just like to know why he didn't swat one of those flies. Stories is the story of the Jericho Road, the Good Samaritan. Here is a rummy story to stop all rummy stories. Picture this. This bird lying out there in the middle of the road, he's stripped, he's naked, he's all beat up, and he's half dead. He's lying out there in the road. Along comes a priest, and he sees him there, and he recognizes what it is. He's a drunk. And all that's happened to him, he's got beat up and rolled. They rolled him. He has nothing. He's lying out there all beat up, half dead. So the priest, this is no concern of his. He's not going to get involved, so he crosses the street on the other side and passes by. Along comes a Levite. Likewise, he sees this rummy lying out there in the road all beat up and rolled. He does the same thing. He's not going to get involved. It's nothing to him. So he passes by. But aha, here comes this next guy, the Samaritan. The Samaritans were not the favored people in those days. But this fellow is a traveling salesman. You don't believe it? I'll prove it to you. And likewise, he's a rummy. This is a rummy salesman. There's a lot of them. He sees this bird, and he recognizes the earmarks immediately. That's a brother under the skin lying out there. So he gets down off of his form of conveyance, which certainly wasn't a Chevrolet, it was probably a mule. And he got down there, and what does it say he did for that guy? He gave him a drink. Read that story. He gave him some wine, and he ministered to him, and he put him on his form of conveyance, and what did he do? He took him to an inn, a hotel. Here's how I know the whole ball of wax comes out now. So he says to this innkeeper, he says, here, take care of this fellow. And here's some money. You notice he gave the money to the innkeeper, not the rummy. He says, take care of this fellow. Here's how I know he's a traveling salesman. He says, if any more of you do, I will repay you next time I come by. He's traveling the territory. There's the first AA call on record. These are the things I was taught. These are the things which were meaningful to me in my beginnings in this fellowship. I was taught something about prayer and meditation. I was taught something about how to work with people and how people should be worked with. And I was taught never to go out on an AA errand without first being prepared through prayer. This might be the reason a lot of people that I have known have stayed sober for 30 some odd years. You might think about that. A long time before I found out anybody ever slips and has trouble. This shook me very badly when I found out people do fall off of this. I never figured they would, but some did. I made it my business. I'm not like the guy. I hear people say, well, if somebody give you a watch, you don't take it apart to see what it runs and make it run. The hell I don't. I wanted to find out why these people got drunk. So when they got got drunk, I went out to see them
and talk to them and find out why they got drunk. Because I thought it was impossible that anyone would ever get drunk again when he'd embraced this program. So I found out the reasons. There are a few reasons. Most reasons are based on selfishness and neglect. Sins of omission, not commission. We change our sense of values and we forget where we started and what gave us the opportunity to be here. Other things become more important to us than the fundamentals we were taught in AA. It's insidious, and we must constantly guard against this through, and the only way I know to guard against it is not fear it, but to improve ourselves. Once we take this program and we accept it, and we apply it, from that point on, it's imperative that we grow in three areas of our life: mentally, morally, and spiritually. If we never forget this, we'll never have trouble. I'll say another thing. I'll give you another ironclad guarantee. If we come to AA and we accept this program and apply it to our lives, first 9 steps of this program, our life will change, and we can keep it changed very simply. One of the greatest ways of keeping this program, keeping ourselves changed into a good attitude, is by using our 10th step every night, every day of our life, a daily check on ourselves. And this is something that most people overlook. I hear people talk about these inventory steps, and they get this 4th step all screwed up with the 10th step, and there's no relationship to the two of them at all. The 4th step says something about taking a moral inventory, searching and fearless moral inventory. It's, we're trying to find out what we have to live with and to get along with, and what's left to us, and what assets and liabilities we have. The 10th step doesn't say that. It says we're taking a personal inventory. That's a check on our daily activity. I keep my program very simple. I'm not smart enough to have a complicated program. And my 10th step is very simple. I will share it with you. I do this every night. This has been going on for years, and it's habitual with me. Last thing after I'm in bed and I'm alone, this is my prayer time. Now I think about my day, what I've done, who I've been with, and who I've seen, and what has occurred. Sometimes some of the things I've done today I'm not too proud of, and sometimes I've offended someone. I don't really mean to, but I do it sometimes. You're bound to when you're dealing with people. I'm a salesman, and I've often said that I think there should be a day put aside every year when a salesman can shoot people with impunity. I see I have some friends in the profession. And it's true. People can really get to you sometimes. But anyway, I think about my day. If I have any apologies to make, I don't get to you sometimes. But anyway, I think about my day. If I have any apologies to make, I don't waste any time getting it done. And you know why? It isn't big things that cause an alcoholic to go bad in AA. It's little things. I've seen some tremendous disasters happen to people in AA in their personal lives. They didn't get drunk over it. I've seen some awful tragedies occur. They didn't get drunk. But I've seen people like these two boys I mentioned a while ago, 30 years in AA, get drunk. Why? Little things. It's the little things that throw us. And if we don't
don't take care of these little things day by day, they grow and they get too much for us to carry. And they change our sense of values. We start excusing ourselves from this and from that, and we don't face issues. And we get into a different world again. These are the little things that we should take care of every day with our 10th step. It's a tremendous step, and don't ever get it confused with number 4, because this is one of the living steps. We have 3 living steps, 10th, 11th, and 12th. We keep ourselves straight by 10. We learn how to pray and what to pray for in 11. And the 12th tells us something else about what we should be doing. Our 11th step is a tremendous step because it leads us into a prayer life. Listen to this step, what it says. Try to absorb this. It says something in our 11th step that we're seeking something, that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It's a lot of words, isn't it? What does it mean? We're seeking something through prayer and meditation. Just what does that mean? To me, prayer is talking to God, and meditation is listening to Him. I've often said that the good Lord gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth. That should suggest something to us in our prayer life. We sought through prayer and meditation. What are we seeking? To improve our conscious contact with God by talking to Him and listening to Him. I can feel that He's as close to me as you are. See? Not way out in the blue yonder where you're unattainable. Right here. The good book says He's closer than hands and feet, and it's awful close. So we're learning how to communicate with Him since we turned our will and our life over to Him in the 3rd step. Don't ever forget that 3rd step. That's the one that separates the men from the boys. That 3rd step determines whether we're in AA or we're around AA. That's the deal. Prayer and meditation improve our conscious contact with God. Now it tells us what we're praying for. A lot of people, they get up in the morning, they pray for sobriety. Don't pray for sobriety. You have sobriety. Thank Him for it at night. Pray for strength, guidance, and direction. What do you want me to do, God? I am your servant. I've turned my will and my life over you. You're running my life. What do you want me to do? This is what the 11th step means. This is what it meant back in the old Oxford group. That's what it means in AA. In AA, we have 200 well-chosen words, which we call the 12 steps, and that's our program. It's no use changing it. It's no use screwing it up. It's infallible. If we'll use it. Our program is so simple, but people complicate it. I hear people talking about this program. They want to know when they should take this step and when they want to take that step, when they should do that. They ask me these questions. I say, well, when do you want to get well? Okay. This week? Is a prescription for living. Supposing you get sick, very desperately ill, and you call a doctor in, and he looks you over and gives you an examination, so he sits down and writes out a prescription for you with 12 ingredients in it. Well, you know enough about Latin, maybe, to recognize several things that he's written on there out of these 12 things. And you look at this one thing and, oh, I don't like that stuff. It's sour. And this other item here, I don't like that because it makes me belch. And this other stuff always gives me a headache. So there's 3 or 4
of things in there that I don't like in that prescription. That other stuff's all right. It don't bother me much.
So I take this prescription to the druggist.
Say, hey, Mr. Druggist, the doctor gave me this stuff, but I don't want you to put this stuff in because it makes me belch. This stuff here gives me a headache. The other stuff makes me sneeze. Or anything. So I just leave that stuff out. So he fills the prescription minus these three or four ingredients. Do you think you're going to get well? By what rules of common sense, if any, does a person think he can get well by taking this prescription for a living or the 12 steps and doing as he damn pleases with it? These steps are numbered 1 to 12. They say, well, what? How should I take them? I mean, which one should I take first? Can you count?
Never get
at the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much. That's it.